back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am here with my very, very good friend, Mr. David Pascarella. What's up, Dave?
Good day, good evening, good afternoon, whenever you're listening.
How's everything?
All right, not bad.
As we record, now this is going to be posted much, much later, but as we record, we are on the cusp of Valentine's Day. So Dave and I picked two books that have absolutely nothing to do with amore. But this, you know, like I said, we're on the cusp. And this Sunday is the Route 110 show, which I am probably going to end up missing for the first time in a few months.
Oh, my goodness. And why is that?
Because, I just don't have any cash in my wallet. And I don't feel like going to the bank and making a withdrawal.
Maybe Cupid will bring you some for Valentine's Day.
Cupid can bring me a copy of Amazing Fantasy number 15. You know, just reminiscing about that a little bit. A few years back, and I mean, we're talking easily 10 years, but there's a picture, and I've posted it on Facebook a few times, of me holding a graded copy of Amazing Fantasy 15. I think it was like a 2.5, something like that. And it was going for, I think it was $5,000. And I thought, oh, my God, $5,000. Where can I get $5,000 to get this? Now I see that same book, like in lesser condition, going for like $25,000. That would have been a very worthwhile investment had I realized back then. Not that I would have sold it anyway.
But you see, if you had a big fat pension, you could have picked that up easy.
And just for those of you who are not in the know, because I'm going to edit some of our earlier conversation out, Dave and I were discussing pensions for different people and how some people get obscene dollar amounts for their pensions, and that does not include Dave and I. But, you know, again, as I said to Dave, I'm not crying poverty. I live a comfortable life, but I'm not making nearly the pension that some of these people make. Anyway.
I'm surprised that that book doesn't go for more with the popularity of the character today. Just because everything seems completely unhinged today.
Yeah. It absolutely is. But, you know, I have, by really being careful about when I'm willing to make the leap into expensive books, I have gotten a lot of books that go for, at least, you know, from what I've been seeing following it on eBay, where I've, you know, it's like, okay, I'll bite the bullet and I'll spend $100 on this book. And then I see it on eBay, you know, where in a similar condition, they're looking for $300 and $400 for it. So again, whether they're getting that price, I don't know. And certainly it's not easy to just turn these books into cash, but hopefully I'm making good investments by being prudent on when I spend the money.
eBay is a mixed bag. It's hit or miss. Sometimes you really get a great deal. I scored for a great price G.I. Joe 155, you know, the last book of the series. And I convinced I got that because the person who sold it didn't list it properly and didn't really know what they had.
Yeah, that's very possible. But I sold my favorite eBay story, and I've probably told it several times. I sold What If number 12, which was What If Jane Foster Had the Hammer of Thor. And I sold it actually.
I heard they made a whole movie about that.
Exactly. A friend, Dario, actually sold it for me on his eBay account. And we listed it. I had the full run of What If, so it was breaking up the full run by putting it on. But they had just announced the movie. And Dario put it on his eBay page for me. And he sold it for, I think, it was somewhere between $220 and $280 for that issue. And I said, okay, I'll wait a few years and I'll find it again. Now, I didn't find it again, but Scott found it for me about a year ago for $12.
Stop it. You're kidding me.
So it's been replaced in my collection at a net profit of at least $208.
Why was it only 12 bucks?
Because the movie wasn't that popular. And I guess, you know, maybe it was somebody who didn't know that there was a market for it, but I don't even think the market is that big anymore.
Wow.
I sold it when it was at its hottest and bought it when it went back to normal, because that's the price it should go for.
You're like a day trader in comic books.
Exactly. And I'm not, I don't like being a speculator on stuff like that, but actually I guess what I was doing was I was taking advantage of the speculators.
You know, well, good for you. See, I always, all the crap I buy, I look at it as, I'm never selling this. This is for me.
That's generally what I do too. There was a point where I was paring down the collection a little bit, getting rid of some of the stuff that, you know, I picked up over the years that I didn't have any use for anymore. And, you know, that's when I talk about how I focused my collecting to specific, you know, I put specific ends to series that I, you know, I'm only going to collect up to this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was getting rid of a lot at that point. And then I started listing a lot of them on eBay myself, and I sold a decent number of them, but some left me with a bad taste in my mouth just because some of the buyers would complain about the stupidest stuff.
That's another reason I don't want to be in the business of selling stuff. I got rid of a lot.
Yeah, well, when I die, that's up to my kids to do.
I got rid of that Star Wars stuff I had what was it, like early 2000s, the Imperial Shuttle and all that. Dario did it for me as well. But it kinda, I didn't want to deal with it.
Well, I had a copy of Spider-Man 2099, and it introduced Venom 2099. and I don't even remember. When I would list these things, I'd look to see what other people were asking for them, and I'd put it in that range. And that probably was, at that point, like maybe, say, a $20 book. And it had a slight, I mean, and I'm talking slight, like chip tear in the upper corner. And I put a picture of it. You know, I had the picture of the whole book, and then I had a close-up of that. And I put it in the description that it had this slight chip missing. And the guy bought it. And then he had the nerve to complain about it because of that chip. And he demanded his money back. And I actually made the case to eBay saying, you know, I listed this, you know, why should I be giving this guy his money back? And what they did was they reimbursed him the money and they let me keep the money he paid for it. Which I think, from what I've heard, is a very rare thing, because I'm told that eBay almost universally sides with the buyer.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, clearly he didn't know how to read. Did you point out the fact that he didn't know how to read?
I didn't mention his ability to or not to read, but I did mention that I had listed it and I had made a point of it. You know, I wasn't trying to hide anything. So that really left a bad taste in my mouth, even though ultimately it didn't cost me anything. I just was very bothered by the fact that it even became an issue.
Well, it's the aggravation of the whole situation.
So eventually I got to the point where I had enough of it. I gave away some of the books that I had for sale that I thought were better books that I wanted to give to people who would appreciate them. And some of the volume that I was getting rid of that were, you know, nothing special, I brought them over to Kyle's and I said, you know, how much credit will you give me per box? I had like about three short boxes of books to get rid of. I don't even remember how much he gave me.
Well, sometimes in those situations when you want to make room, it's a win.
Yeah. In that case, I thought it was. I'm sure I got less. I'm sure I lost on the transaction, that I got less for them than I paid to buy them. But at that point, they didn't have any value to me anymore anyway.
You made more than if you put them in the recycle pail.
Or the shredder.
Ba-dum-bum.
So I do keep the ones I really like, though. Anyway, so we brought two random books today, and by chance, they are both by Marvel, even though yours is not a traditional Marvel hero book. But I have the older book. And I'll tell you, I actually was going to go. I went for an issue of Marvel Team-Up, and I was going to go for one of the later volumes. And it was actually a team-up that did not include Spider-Man. And I thought, oh, that might be interesting to cover. But then I just had second thoughts, and I went for a classic Marvel Team-Up, issue number 14. Which is Spider-Man and the Submariner, or at the time when this came out, what I would call Spider-Man and the Submariner, because I didn't know any better back then. So this had a release date of July 24th of 1973 and a cover date of October of 1973. The cover, which is credited to Gil Kane, Frank Giacoia, and Gaspar Saladino, shows the Submariner and Spider-Man fighting in the water at what appears to be a pier, and they're actually kind of under the water somewhat, and they're both in kind of an awkward position the way it's drawn. And it says, two free swinging superstars for the price of one. Mayhem is the Manfish, which is an interesting title. So the story synopsis, actually, I'm not going to read the synopsis because it looks to be too bare bones. I'm going to just give my own description. So Spider-Man's swinging around town to get some exercise, and he spies upon a man in an overcoat and a fedora about to be mugged by three different gentlemen. And he's thinking, I got to help this guy. But he does see that the man in the fedora is doing pretty well defending himself, until one of the guys who he thinks is knocked out comes up behind him with a switchblade, which Spider-Man quickly webs that guy's arm and pulls him back. As that happens, the fedora falls off of the man, and we see that it is the Submariner. Now, at this point, the Submariner is very much a persona non grata in the Marvel world, much the way Spider-Man was, where the police assume the worst about him, and so does just the public at large. So Spider-Man thinks that he's, you know, that he's got ill intentions, and the two of them battle a bit. Ultimately, there's a ship that escapes, and the Submariner, you know, falls into a deep depression because he, you know, he was trying to save someone or get someone or something. And at that point, Spider-Man realizes, oops, in doing the traditional superhero battle for a team-up issue, I have misjudged his motivations and I've done the wrong thing. So the Submariner tells him about the Tiger Shark and Dr. Dorcas, and how ultimately they caused the death of his father, Leonard Mackenzie, which I think was in Submariner 46, somewhere around there. So it would be a few years before this issue. So they decide they're going to go after those two villains. And at that point, we join the two villains. And at that point, Dorcas is kind of keen on the idea that they're going to catch him, because he has four giant test tubes with the men fish in it, which are four kind of mutated fish looking things that he can control.
This plot sounds a lot like something we covered for Tales for Legends of the JSA. We're creating four villains like that. I'm sorry, I should have interrupted.
Yeah, that was
right. Didn't we cover something recently like that? Relatively recent.
I think we did. I think you're absolutely right about that. Where they did some. I can't. You know, you listeners, look at our back. Go listen to our back episodes and let us know when that was. So anyway, they decide to go after the two villains, and Submariner swims while Spider-Man does what I don't think you really can do. And he's on web skis, and he webs the Submariner, and he's being pulled along. So he's kind of like water skiing with his webs.
Like
I don't think that really works. And they also have a thing in there that I don't think works either, where he had put he's using his spider sense to somehow follow them, which, you know, I think it's a misuse of the spider sense, because the spider sense is really just supposed to be like, it warns him that something bad is going to happen. It's not supposed to be, you know, it's kind of like a spider when you go to crush it, and at the last second it jumps out of the way because it's got spider sense. That's the whole idea of it. And otherwise, any other use of it, I feel like they're overdoing it. And so they enter into, they take this big tubular elevator down to where the villains are, and they attack them. But at that point, they find that they aren't really the villains. They are kind of fish in the villains' costumes. And that drugs the two of them, and they are unconscious and put into, you know, held captive. So Spider-Man is held captive in a tube, but they, but as Dorcas points out, there's little holes at the bottom that allow air to get in so that he's not suffocating. And then they get them left alone, and Spider-Man is somehow able to shoot his web shooter through the little hole and open up, use that to get to a control to open a hatch to let water in, which revives the Submariner.
I'm confused already.
Yeah, really. So Dorcas frees the fishmen, and they go for a confrontation with Spider-Man while Tiger Shark is fighting with the Submariner. And Submariner feels like he's losing his strength while Tiger Shark is staying strong as ever, and he's questioning why that would be until he realizes he's being dehydrated while Tiger Shark has water in his suit. So he rips open the suit to let the water out and then says, let's see who's stronger. And he knocks the Tiger Shark out. While Spider-Man's still fighting these stupid manfish. And the base is ready to explode. So the two of them dive. Well, they take the elevator up. And you could just hear the elevator music as they're doing it. That is our theme song. How we have the girl from Ipanema as our theme song, I'm not sure, but that is. Then the two of them swim far away, and the lab explodes, and Spider-Man says, your father is avenged, Namor, and then Namor says, is he? Yes, perhaps, but now that it's over, I wonder. Would he have wanted a blazing pyre such as this as a monument or a simple token of peace?
Oh, now you come up with this.
So this, I mean, I love old Marvel team of issues, and I love Brave and the Bold issues and DC Comics Presents and Marvel 2-in-1. This one just has an overbearing stench of let's just throw something together. Now, that's not to say I don't enjoy it for the value of what it actually is, but purely on its own, this is not a good story. It's not very well written. And as much as I love Gil Kane's art, and this is not bad Gil Kane, it does feel a little bit like rushed Gil Kane.
Yeah.
Had you ever read this one when you were doing your early read through? Did you get to this?
I did not get this far, but even if I hadn't seen the cover, if I saw the Submariner, you know, with the hat and the overcoat, I knew that's who he was, because I think that's how he first appears in the Fantastic Four.
Well, he's got the long beard too, because he's amnesiac, or right. Amnesiac. He has the amnesia.
He don't remember anything.
That's it.
I felt Spider-Man though jump the gun on this. He didn't want to listen at all.
Yeah, I mean, well, because we have to have our traditional team-up superhero battle.
I just felt somewhere in this it needed the line, in another reality, I could have called you friends.
Yeah, I think that would have worked.
But yeah, it was out of control.
Now, I'm just looking. I wanted to look and see.
We definitely, though, I'm telling you, we covered a book that was very similar like this. Maybe it was the one with Johnny Thunder of Earth One or something.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it.
And he created four superpowered entities.
Yeah.
It was like this, four weird looking things.
Yeah, four things where it's like I really can't invest a lot of time or effort or creativity into them because I know they're just throwaways that are never going to be back again.
You mean they're never coming back?
I don't believe so. I'm just assuming they don't.
Just wait. There'll be a miniseries next year telling you what happened to them.
Yeah. Well, let me just click on them in the Marvel Wiki page and see
how funny would it be if they come back.
Well, following the destruction of Dorcas's lab, a normal piranha that survived the explosion,
of course,
was exposed to residue radiation from Dorcas's experiments. The exposure caused it to evolve into a humanoid creature known as the Piranha. So they're not back, but they're kind of back.
We're back. We're bad. Clearly, radiation works a different way in the Marvel Universe, which is fine by me. Yeah. They should do a crossover with DC and the Shark.
But yeah, well, I love the Shark. I love when they portray him in live action. I don't think these guys would do as well. Now, the Tiger Shark character was a key Namor villain. And I feel like he's used as a throwaway in here, too. You know, Dorcas was, too, because he was like a manipulative scientist. So these were two, you know, in his own book, these were two significant villains. And I think they may have been used here because they wanted to get exposure for the character, see if they could bump up the sales of his own comic. But I think it was a mistake to use them this way, because I think you diminished them.
Does Tiger Shark show up relatively early in Namor's run?
I think it was issue 5.
So that I read. I knew the whole backstory of that one. I'm so proud of myself when I know the backstory of something.
I'm proud of you too, Dave.
I'm glad. But you know the water skiing scene? All Spider-Man needed was a leather jacket.
Yeah, this is the issue when Spider-Man jumped the shark.
When he jumped the shark. He's the Fonz. And when they find the derelict ship that's the entrance way to this underwater hideout, I kept thinking of You Only Live Twice, where Q Branch has that headquarters in the derelict ship.
And then they should have gone into a dormant volcano.
But it would have been better if the ship was like canted on its on an angle.
Yeah. Agreed. So, like I said, I feel like they mischaracterized everything in here with them fighting each other and with the characters, you know, the villains being minimalized. And then just a quick ending to the story, creating these Mort villains and then just destroying them. So, not one of the better issues. Again, I can read it on its own in the, the Bob Haney attitude of Brave and the Bold. But as far as it being a serious issue, I have a tough time with that.
Yeah. The suit he's wearing with the water in it, that was also vaguely familiar of something else. But I can't quite put my finger on it.
Well, I know, eventually, which was not too long after this, when he got the black war outfit that Reed Richards actually made for him, that was because he was starting to have a reaction to air, and that had some way of keeping him moist, if you
moist will. Very good. How do you defeat the Submariner with a blow dryer?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it was goofy fun. I will say that. Yeah, it wasn't something I had to slog through and go, oh, God, I wish this was over already.
That's the best thing it had going for it. It was a quick read, and it had elements of lightheartedness to it.
But now, if you were a kid, well, you were a kid when you bought this.
Yes, right? I was a kid when I bought this, yes.
It was probably a fun story.
Yeah, it was. And I, I had bought this. I had started buying a few issues later. I think the first issue of Marvel Team Up I bought off the stands, I think, was number 18. But I had picked this up at Joe Erb's comic store not too long after that.
See, that already bumps the grade up.
This probably cost me, this has a 20-cent price on the cover, and I probably had to spend like 35 cents for it. Almost double.
That's why he was a good businessman.
Professor Allen would be quite upset with me, with 12-year-old Paul.
Did you have fear of missing out?
Of course. FOMO. So I guess I could rate, give this one, unless you have something else to add on.
I'm just going to say, isn't it great that he refers to him as Spock at one point?
Yes.
You're with your Spocky ears. Go get your shine box.
I mean, there was definitely a character similar look. I don't think it was intentional. I mean, Namor existed way before Spock did. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Namor was a popular enough character for them to try and duplicate him on in the comics.
Go ahead. I'm sorry for derailing you.
So I'm going to give the cover a C+. I think like the they're very awkwardly posed. I mean, I know they're underwater and all, but it's like it would grab me because of the two characters that are in it, but not, it wouldn't be that I, you know, like if this was two characters I had a mild interest in, I wouldn't look at this cover and think, oh man, I have to have this. So I'm going to give it a C+, slightly better than average, but nothing special. The interior art, and like I said, I've always loved Gil Kane, and even bad Gil Kane is pretty darn good. But this feels a little bit rushed, and I think it really needed to have a better inker than William Howard, who I'm not familiar with at all. I think it could have been just cleaned up just a little bit and made better. I mean, there's some dynamic shots, some standard Gil Kane poses. I'm going to say a B- on the interior art. It's not bad. It's pretty good, in fact, but it could be better. Some of it looks like Dorcas's face just lacks some detail and looks a little too cartoony for me at points. The story itself is dumb fun, which gets a C+. And overall, I'll give the book a C+.
I'm going to go slightly below you on everything. The cover's, you know, interesting because of the characters on it. It really doesn't have much to it other than appear in a background, you know, a slight background. I do like they have both the bubbles with each of the, I guess, their logos. Was Marvel slapping logos on the covers at this time?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's not Spider-Man's standard logo, but that is the Submariners.
Okay. I mean, it's neat. But I'm only going to give it a C. I don't think it rates better than that. And the interior art, I'm not a Gil Kane fan. You know, it's not my thing.
Sure.
So I want me to C on the interior art as well. The story, it's dopey fun. The biggest negative is, okay, I get you want to do the whole, okay, the two heroes are going to fight each other. I don't know if Namor was much of a hero at this point. I know he kind of blew either way. So I kind of think, though, Spider-Man should have heard him out, but you would have lost the battle between the two of them.
But then you could have lengthened the actual battle right. with the villains, which would have made that story probably better.
It did seem, you know, with the battle with the villains, it's like, we're out of time now. We got to wrap this up.
We're going to turn over all the cards.
So I'm going to give it a C. So solid C across the board.
All right. And what have you got for us today, Dave?
I have brought for us, for your approval, my subtle continuing of the G.I. Joe saga with G.I. Joe number 3. Let me just get myself together here. Okay. The cover of this book was done by Bob Hall and Alan Milgram. This is G.I. Joe again, number 3. Cover dated from September 1982. On sale June 1st of 1982 for a whopping 60 cents. This was written by Larry Hama. Penciler Herb Trimpe, inker Jack Abel, and edited by Tom DeFalco. The Trojan Gambit. The G.I. Joe team has just come off a successful raid of a Cobra stronghold. In addition to the capture of Cobra personnel, part of the prize catch is a battle robot. On General Flagg's orders, the robot is covertly transported in U.S. mail trucks to the G.I. Joe headquarters, the Pit. The Pit is a secret underground installation hidden underneath the motor pool of the Chaplain Assistant School at Fort Wadsworth, in of all places, Staten Island. Although Flash has scanned, not that Flash, the G.I. Joe Flash, has scanned and dismantled the robot from top to bottom for any signs of booby traps, he finds nothing. Hours later, the Joes are through with the scanning, and the robot is left in pieces, awaiting removal by the experts from Aberdeen the next day. Hawk informs them that he and Scarlet are going upstairs to host a social tea for the chaplain assistants. The social tea is held in the motor pool above the pit. The Joes always maintain a cover as Jeep jockeys for the chaplains. While Hawk and Scarlet run the tea, Clutch, Stalker, and Breaker decide to have breakfast in the canteen, while Snake Eyes, Flash, and Stalker store their weapons in the armory. Unbeknownst to them, the robot is a sleeper, programmed to activate at a preset time. Clearly, Flash's scan was a pretty shitty job. Cobra is banking on the robot to reveal to them the exact location of the pit. The dismantled hand moves and makes its way to the computers and activates the blast doors, sealing the Joes in the rooms where they were. Clutch, Stealer, and Breaker are trapped in the canteen, while Stalker, Snake Eyes, and Flash become trapped in the arms room. The blast door to the canteen is locked by a counterweight, the access to which is opened by Clutch. Stealer, bragging that he's used to changing bogey wheels on tanks in the field, lifts the 200-pound counterweight long enough for Breaker to shove a chair in to prop the door open. It's a 200-pound weight, and he holds it open with what looks like a folding chair. Somehow I don't see that working. Meanwhile, finding themselves in the same situation, Stalker and Snake Eyes manage to doze off and go to sleep to conserve air in the room, while Flash uses his laser rifle on low power to burn the door open. After getting out of the canteen, Clutch, Breaker, and Stealer have suspected that the robot may have something to do with what's going on. They're correct, but they didn't figure that it would have assembled itself and be in full attack mode. Cut off from any weaponry, the trio is forced to improvise. Clutch douses the robot with aftershave and lights it on fire. Meanwhile, the incidents within the pit have not gone unnoticed to the visitors in the motor pool. Earlier on, they smelled Clutch's cooking of bacon and eggs, and now they are noticing the faint smell of an electrical fire. Hawk and Scarlet do their best to convince the visitors that this is nothing to be concerned about. It's just shifting winds. The trio from the canteen go and take cover. When they emerge to look for the robot, they find no sign of it. They slowly make their way into the training area. Surprise, it turns out the robot hid in the swimming pool to extinguish the fire. The Joes quickly retreat into an elevator and manage to reach the garage level where their vehicles are stored. But having no ammunition, they are completely useless. Suddenly, they hear the robot coming up after them in the elevator shaft. Clutch quickly sends the elevator car crashing down on the robot. But like a massive Terminator, the robot shrugs it off and continues climbing. The Joes then push down the HAL laser cannon, but it misses the robot, who's smart enough to stand on the ledge to dodge the falling object. It blasts through the doors and continues up the stairs. The robot finally reaches the garage floor and breaks the doors open. Stealer throws a can of silver paint on the robot's head, forcing it to rely on radar instead of its visual receptors. The radar bounces off a large sheet of radar reflective foil, covering the opening to the hydraulic lift. Believing the chasm to be a solid floor, it steps through the foil and goes crashing down to destruction. The commotion does not go unnoticed in the motor pool above, but Hawk refuses to break from their cover and assures the visitors that there is nothing to worry about and it's merely an acoustic phenomena. Flash, Stalker, and Snake Eyes finally join their comrades to find much of the excitement dwindling down. Although destroyed, the robot refuses to give up. Its head detaches, sprouts tentacles, and tries to climb up the shaft. Flash knocks it down with his laser rifle. The head falls to the ground, only to release insect-like robots. Breaker identifies them as mobile transmitters designed by Cobra to locate the pit. A quick search and destroy mission neutralizes most of the robot insects, but for one. Up in the motor pool, one of the Padres notices something coming out of the grate on the floor and assumes it's a real insect. Scarlet reassures the elderly man and intercepts it by simply crushing it with a foot, ending the threat of the robot. With the time limit for the robot's mission over, Cobra is forced to head back to their base before their helicopter fuel runs out. One of the guests claims he is cheering below, but another dismisses it as more of the acoustic phenomena mentioned by the colonel. So what did we think of this?
You know, you're dragging me kicking and screaming into the world of G.I. Joe, but you're doing it in small enough doses that it's making me kind of come along for the ride without a problem. You know, I mean, if I'm remembering correctly, I didn't feel the first issue did a good enough job of introducing the characters. It felt more like we're coming up with toys kind of issue. Whereas the second one, I thought, did a much better job of showcasing some of the people and giving you just kind of a feel for them. And I think this one is kind of building on that. It's not really giving us a lot more in the way of character development, but it's using those characters and putting them into a situation. Excuse me. It's using those characters and putting them into a situation where they have to use their skill sets and move along, which I feel is kind of good. You know, now that we had the issue where they were introduced, it's like, okay, to have an action issue here, which I feel is like kind of what we're doing. It's not really total action, but it's, you know, like you say, it's got a little bit of that Terminator feel to it. A little bit of, what was it, X-Men 143, when Kitty Pryde is in there with the demon in the house. A little bit of Alien. You know, there's just a little bit of, you know, like you're in your own place and there's the threat on your lives. So I like that. I thought it was pretty well done. I thought the way they got through it was good. You know, that they tried different things that didn't work and that it just kept coming. And even when they really kind of disposed of it, it was still trying to keep coming. So I thought that was pretty cool. The artwork in the issue, I feel, is adequate. I like Herb Trimpe. I always have. There's stuff like where he shows like the hydraulics bringing the truck down into the base and things like that I just think are pretty cool and well done. Some of the action, I feel, with a couple of carefully placed panels that maybe were bigger, you know, half page or something like that, could make this so much more dynamic when the battle is going on and make the robot seem more physically threatening. That's the one thing that I really feel would have just brought this issue up a level. So it's not that the artwork is bad. I think the artwork is pretty good. I think it, you know, follows the story. I just feel like it could have been just a touch more dynamic. And again, I would have chosen it for the shots when the robot would seem at its most dangerous, to make it more, you know, more dynamic then, because I think that would have heightened the suspense and the action in the book. But other than that, I really don't have a lot of criticism.
This was one of the first back issues I bought because I came into this at number 5 and worked my way back. And I remember getting this one. I think I got this from Caesar's Bay Bazaar. There was a comic shop, you know, a comic guy in there.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. So this was, what year did I say? This was 82. So I was 10 years old when I got this. Not yet 11. And I was kind of disappointed. At the time, I was disappointed in this. And the reason was, when you look at the cover.
The cover is more dynamically drawn. Oh, it's kind of exactly what I'm saying.
And they're shooting at it. And then I got into the story and you find out they have no ammunition. And there's no shooting whatsoever. I was disappointed in this.
I could see that. I get exactly what you're saying. And I think it's exactly what you're saying and what I'm saying. That I think this cover is drawn in a dynamic way where the robot seems incredibly threatening. And you want to see, you know, how are they going to defeat this thing? And I feel like that's what the artwork needed to do a little bit more of inside.
But I will say, having read this now again, how many years later, the story's, you know, it's pretty good. At least I thought.
Yeah.
You know, it's the Terminator before the Terminator. I almost got a vibe of like a Friday the 13th, you know, that type of character coming at them, unstoppable. I remember most being, as a kid, they're trapped in the armory and Flash is going to use the laser rifle. And he's like, we got to conserve oxygen and the other two just go to sleep. Until this day, I'm fascinated with people who can do that. I trade my right arm to be able to go, okay, I'm going to go to sleep. And in like 2 minutes, you're out. But I did like
that's,
a lot.
That's what happens to me every night, by the way. When we decide it's time to go to sleep, I just roll over and go to sleep. And Tina finds it very frustrating.
You can do that? Seriously?
I can do that at that point in time. But then what happens is during the night, I'll wake up and I'll, you know, I'll have some restless time during the night, but I fall asleep. When it's time to go to sleep, I fall asleep right away.
Oh, you're so lucky. I have such problems with that. I like the little, what would you say? The nods to factual things that you can tell they're familiar with the area and the geography. Where there's the reference jokingly, hey, how come we're taking the Verrazano Bridge instead of the ferry? The ferry's a much nicer ride. I like that they reference the prisoners are being sent to Fort Hamilton, which
just
is
on the other
Brooklyn.
Side of the Verrazano.
And I'm very familiar with Fort Wadsworth. I haven't located the secret entrance yet, but it's completely open to the public today.
Give it time.
And like you, I love the scene on page 4 with the truck going down as well. I'm a sucker for schematics of bases, the Bat Cave, you name it. I love that stuff. And there was always the bonus again with this, I've said it before, that it takes place quite literally in our backyard.
Yep. Well, your backyard.
My backyard.
You're in Staten Island, I'm in Long Island.
Right, but when we grew up, we were both across the bridge in Brooklyn.
That is true.
The robot, and I mentioned this the last show we were on with Scott, this robot also reminds me of the Star Wars comic book, the issue with the Droid World, whatever that was in the mid-40s. It just has that very, I don't know, Star Warsian, you know, comic droid vibe to me, particularly the way it looks on the cover.
You got the Droid World on your mind.
You know, I think we may have to revisit that one.
I think we might have to, since it's come up twice already.
Two in a row. Well, what kind of crappy job did he do scanning this thing? Oh, yeah, there's no time. There's nothing. It's completely inert.
And meanwhile, each part of it is independent.
Maybe Cobra should have just put a small nuke in the thing.
Yeah, that would have worked. That would have been a lot easier.
There's also the remark made by, you know, one of the guests at this tea social about, oh, the decorations are beautiful. And Hawk says, well, you know, when we're not driving the Padre to church, we're out fighting international terrorists. And she's like, oh, you're so funny.
A little inside humor.
They also point out how Snake Eyes likes to clean all the weapons because he doesn't want your rifle jamming when you're covering him.
Well, that's actually a good point. You know, and I have to tell you, I have cans sitting around my house that say, like, silver paint on them.
Just in case.
Yeah, you never know.
You never know with that robot.
I'm always taking aluminum foil and covering holes in the backyard.
But they do explain to you, you know, that's whole radar jamming and stuff. So I guess, they do. Now you know, and knowing is half the battle. Imagine
the
how
more
many
you, the more you know.
Tin foil we'd need to cover a hole like that.
I wouldn't have enough to make a hat.
You know, I think this is also the last time we're going to see the laser cannon. Maybe we see it once more, and that's it.
Well, you've accomplished, I think, your mission of making me say, okay, I'm starting to understand why people were big G.I. Joe fans back in the day.
This is my mission, to preach the word.
And, you know, we do have to get back to our World War II pick at some point.
What are we up to on that? Is it 4-5?
I don't know. We'd have to look. I don't remember.
You know, I'm not as young as I used to be.
Me neither.
Should we grade this?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm going to say the cover is the strongest part of the book. I mean, you look at this cover, it's dynamic. It's not in the story. I mean, I don't even know if you could noprize it and say, oh, this is the original battle where, you know, they defeated Cobra. Because it didn't seem like the robot was functional to begin with. It's like they took this place and found this thing, you know, in a closet waiting for use. But it certainly is it's a dynamic cover. I was going to buy it anyway because I wanted the whole run. But I would have bought this thinking, oh, this is going to be a fantastic shoot 'em up with this robot. So the cover is a solid, solid A to me. The interior art, I think, is really good. I enjoyed it. Maybe you could adjust some of the panels here and there. But it's, to me, it's what I like to see. All the characters, you know, this era of G.I. Joe, the early ones, pretty much everybody's uniform looks the same. And the fuddy-duddy that I am, I like that. I like military characters to look like they're in the military, as opposed to what came later on where people are dressed like clowns and stuff like that.
Mm.
But despite the similarities of the uniforms, you can pick pretty much everybody out and identify who they are. So to me, that's a strong plus. I like the backgrounds. I like the way the robot, you know, jumped around and put itself together. To me, it looks great. So I'm going to give the interior art an A-. The story, years ago, I would have given it a much lower grade because I was disappointed that the cover didn't reflect what I wanted to see in the book. But having matured over the years, it's a pretty fascinating concept. Part Terminator, part Friday the 13th, whatever you want to call it. And it's the ingenuity that they use in trying to stop this thing. Because, I mean, you think about it, if they had the heavy artillery, they probably could have put this thing down fairly quick. But it's the ingenuity. And the fluke at the end where, you know, the amiable, foolish guy who doesn't know what's going on is the one who ultimately saves the day by calling attention to it and Scarlet smashing it. So I'm going to give the story a B+. You know, years ago, I would have, as a much younger comics reader, it would have been a much lower grade. Because, like I said, this was not one of my favorite issues. I was disappointed in it. But seeing it in a modern eye, B plus. So if I'm going to give it an overall grade of an A minus.
All right. I'm not quite as high as you, but I'm liking this issue. I think the cover is really solid. I think it, like, you know, as you've described it, I don't think it's quite to the point of iconic where I'd go with that. So I'd give it an A minus. I'm not ready to put a poster of it on my wall, but really, really good. The interior art is good for the reasons you described it as being good, but also lacking a little bit, like I said, in that it could just use a little bit more of a dynamic presence to create the threat of this robot. So I can't give it as high as you, but I'm going to say a solid B. I think it's very good. The story, I really like the story. I thought it was a good way of, you know, like I said, continuing where we went with the last issue. So I'm going to say an A minus on the story. And overall, I'll give the book a B.
Oh, good. I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, no, I definitely did. So I'm not opposed to your bringing more G.I. Joe to the table in days to come.
Excellent.
So I guess we're relatively short tonight, but we're there. What the heck? We did two books, and I hope everybody enjoyed listening to us, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.